they cannot work for some reason that is just not clear and also cannot be shared.
So it's about giving everybody a voice, but not a vote.
I think that's exactly what it is. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes. The reason why some of the world's most successful companies are able to stay ahead of disruption is not because they hire a new CEO or expensive consultants. Instead, at least according to Professor Dr. Christian Stadler, these companies have adopted a new way of strategizing. So what this revolutionary concept is about and how leading companies like Barclays, Adidas, Unilever, Telefonica, and even the US Navy have pioneered it is what we will be discussing in this episode of the podcast. Let's go. So Christian, strategy, the term strategy is used very broadly. And you've done a lot of work in this area in the recent years. Could you maybe distill its essence from your perspective? So what is a quote-unquote a strategy?
Sure. You know, the way I like to think about it, identify your most important problems as an organization, and then think whether you have a way to address this. Yeah, that's the sweet spot where you should concentrate your strategy on. You could also phrase it a little bit like, where do I stand today? Where do I want to go? And how do I actually get there? It's three simple, straightforward questions that allow you to get some form of guidance of what you want to achieve in strategy.
So I very much like the three questions because they're easy to remember. Where are we at the moment? Where do we want to go? And how do we get there? So basically understand where you are right now, and then a vision of the future or maybe a goal. Some call it North Star, goal, objective, aim. There is probably different words for that. And then, you know, how do we get there step by step and making a plan? Why do you think we're making strategy oftentimes maybe a bit more complicated?
I don't know. Maybe there's a whole industry that sells strategy. And if you make it too simple, maybe it's harder to sell stuff. You need to create these sort of myths about some sort of, you know, magic happening there where only a few extremely clever magicians are able to do so. That might be, you know, some of it, even though it's often more difficult to really drill down along these very simple lines of questioning. I don't know if there's any other reasons why we do it. It has puzzled me often why we don't keep it like this. I had this conversation with Ashok Vaswani a little while back, who used to head the retail business for Barclays in the UK. And he's actually the one who shared these three questions with me that I mentioned just earlier, which I thought is a brilliant way that allows everyone to be involved in strategy. And why not? You know, it doesn't have to be the domain just of a few selected individuals.
It is a brilliant way of phrasing it. And honestly, you know, I feel you because we've seen the same thing. Now, tell us more about your journey to your book called Open Strategy, because oftentimes, you know, that there might be a moment of clarity, a moment of experience that leads to new ideas, such as opening up traditional strategy making processes. So what made you write and publish your book on Open Strategy?
So it was actually kind of, you know, an unusual and funny story. I had three co-authors on this book, and one of them runs a consulting firm in Germany. They're called IMP. They have helped clients to open up their strategy for a long time. They've done hundreds of projects. And I've sort of, you know, known him and the other two who are professors in the University of Innsbruck for many years. The three of them talked about writing a book about this, and they knew that I've written previously a book for the US market, which they wanted to do. And because I've worked with the two professors, that's Julia Hautz and Kurt Matzler, on numerous projects before, they knew that we would work well together. So they really had this sort of conspiratory meeting in Munich to discuss how they could kind of bring me into this and convince me. And I admit, when they first told me about this, I thought they're crazy. Yeah. Strategy, in my mind, was something that is the domain, the kind of exclusive playing ground for the senior management. That's what they do. You know, that's what they are known for. That's what they stand for. How could you possibly involve large groups of people? But, you know, in hindsight, I'm quite glad that I'm a curious person. So I decided that I will look into this a little bit more. So I joined some of the workshops that the German consulting company did, then started to talk to other firms who have done things that involve larger groups of people. And it started to grow on me. And, you know, with time, I realized this is something really outstanding. This is something unusual to find ways, smart ways, to involve large groups of people in decision making, in strategy making. It does not mean that, you know, you turn a company into a democracy, which was my first reaction. I think often people think so, open up, well, you know, everyone can now decide. That's not what it is, yeah? But consult large groups of people. So an unusual story, I guess, yeah? I cannot claim that I had the idea, but at least I was smart enough to notice with time that there is something in here.
So your comment on democracy is a very important one. And I think the approach on open strategy is, as you said, it's quite a departure from where we are today. The traditional way, the, you know, old way, for lack of a better word, the current way is really, as you say, the C-suite or some comparable group, they lock themselves in, you know, boardrooms or do a quote-unquote strategy retreat, maybe bring in one of the big consultancies to cover their butts, and then, you know, they communicate top-down what's to be done. When do you think this approach has become a problem?
Well, it probably has always been a problem, but there's a bit more urgency today because people are used to having a stronger voice than in the past, yeah? If we go into earlier times where everything was a bit more hierarchical, yeah, you might remember when you were younger and you went to one of the government offices, yeah, there's a sort of an automatic intimidation, yeah, you would believe the government official who sits there in the office, you have lots of respect. Nowadays, people don't take these things just like this, yeah, they expect to have more of engagement, more discussions, and, you know, certainly that's true in Western Europe. Out here. Also, you know, all the opportunities to social media that we have to constantly comment on everything. With that, there's an expectation, particularly for younger people, that they don't just take orders, but they have an opportunity to contribute to what is being done. So that, I think, you know, created more urgency. Now, having said that, it would have always been a good idea to probably consult more people in order to figure out what's doable. Because even in the old days, there might not have been sort of open revolution against ideas, but everyone who was not sort of on board probably found small ways to somehow undermine orders that come from above. Yeah, you sit it out, basically. Yeah, a CEO is going to be there for a few years, and the tenure time of CEOs has become shorter and shorter. So, well, you know, whoever is the CEO, maybe she's going to be around for another couple of years or so. I'll pretend to do what they're telling me, but really I do what I think is right.
And how does it work? The strategy process, I mean, there are many frameworks on how strategy processes typically work in organizations, and they're employed by, you know, in some sort of color and some forms by all the organizations. Obviously, you know, larger organizations have maybe a much more structured process, but at least, you know, they take some time, and in smaller companies it's different. But how does it work? What are the core elements of, you know, the open strategy approach?
There's many different techniques, yeah? So I guess before you jump into this, you need to figure out for the type of situation, for the part of the process that you want to open up with, what's the right instrument in this particular instance? Yeah, it will be different if it's about idea generation, if it's about formulating the strategy in detail, or if it's about more the implementation side of strategy. One technique that I like a lot is a nightmare competitor exercise. And the idea is that if organizations possibly could face disruption, then the smartest way to prepare yourself is to think about potential nightmare competitors. So companies, they do not exist, but were they to come into existence, they would present an absolute nightmare for you. The reason we think about it as nightmare competitors rather than sort of, you know, great opportunity that come from disruption is that we know from previous research, a lot of this comes from Clayton Christensen, a professor in Harvard, who first came up with this idea of disruptive innovation, that organization will find it hard to actually do something about disruption, partly because there's the day-to-day business. Yeah, if it's just an opportunity, we'll always say, yeah, sure, you know, there's a great opportunity, we'll do it, but we'll do it tomorrow because today we need to run our business. On the other hand, if something is seen as a substantial threat, I'll act, yeah, I'll do it immediately. So in this exercise, you set up separate teams who create nightmare competitors, and it's a bit sort of Dragon Den style or Shark Tank, if we have an American audience, of these groups competing for the best business idea with rounds of voting, judges, etc., you know, involved in all of this. And it helps you to think outside the box. It helps you to bring in unusual voices into this process. You know, and sort of, you know, ideal setup for this is that half of the participants in such a setup actually come from outside the organization. That's where you really open up even beyond the doors of your own organization to get fresh ideas.
Yeah, and there is, you're touching on many aspects. One is, you know, ambidexterity, which means, yes, you need to run the core business, but at the same time, there needs to be also a group or many groups in the organization that drive innovation forward. Sure, that is one of the things. And the, you know, for the nightmare competitor, you know, exercise, I'm with you. I believe that it, you know, promotes a sense of urgency that maybe wouldn't be in the process if you would not, you know, care about nightmare competitors and how they could disrupt your business in maybe a week or maybe even a month, using technology, using whatever kind of stuff there is. Now,
it doesn't necessarily, sort of interrupting you, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the idea is entirely new, that no one in the organization thought about this before. First Alpine, large steel company, did an exercise of that kind once. And one of the ideas that emerged from it is to use hydrogen-based technology to produce steel, reducing emissions dramatically. And there were, you know, some people in the senior management have come across this before, but the momentum that came out partly from this this workshop, the sort of concrete business model that was created there as well, helped them to spur this further along, and they set up a pilot plant. In the meantime, they created some patents. They've actually set up plans to step by step convert all of their production facilities to this new technology. You know, that'll take time, but it gave them this sort of extra kick that made it possible to move faster than anybody else in the industry.
And does a greater quantity and also diversity of input, strategic input, you know, ideas, always correlate with better outcomes?
No, not necessarily. Yeah. So we did conduct a survey and asked about the benefits of opening up your strategy. There was managers both in Europe and the US whom we asked, senior executives, middle managers, and their response was, I think it was 69% of them said that one of the biggest benefits was in fact more diversity, more ideas. And of course, you know, the chances that you get more of that does somewhat increase with more people. But in that little, you know, nightmare competitor exercise that we just discussed, for example, if you have 60 people in the room, you get fantastic results as well. Mm-hmm. You want to lean towards a larger group of people the more you think about the implementation side of things. You know, and that's where often strategy goes wrong. Not that the ideas are bad, but somehow people either don't understand what's required or they don't like what they hear. By giving people an opportunity to be involved, they're more likely to actually buy into this. Steelcase, American company that produces office furniture, did at the tail end of their strategy making, where the big headlines were all fixed. They did an exercise where they invited everyone to join. Can't remember the exact numbers, but it was, I think, 20,000-30,000 or so possibly who joined in that process. Now, here you wanted a lot of people because it's really about getting everyone on board in that step of the strategy making process.
And that makes a lot of sense. So where would you draw the line between, as you said earlier, democracy and, you know, an open strategy process? It can be, you know, open internally, but also open to, you know, the external environment. But where do you draw the line between those two things? Because I think it's really important to do it.
So I think, you know, from the very beginning, it's really important that there's clear communication about this. If expectations are raised that everyone has a say, then you either disappoint people in the end, or you do things that maybe don't make sense. Yeah, there's certain sort of you know, proprietary information that maybe only the top management has. Hence, some of the things that are suggested, they cannot work for some reason that is just not clear, and also cannot be shared with everyone. So clarity from the beginning is really key. And I would never, in really no instance, turn this into a, okay, this is a vote and this is what we will do. Now, of course, what happens if there's a lot of momentum behind certain ideas, then it's more likely that something happens. Steelcase, what I just mentioned a moment ago, didn't want to really change anything in terms of big initiatives, but there was a fresh idea coming out of this initiative. What had happened is that somebody mentioned that they have opened the design process for a particular product. I think it was some sort of TV that was raising out of a table to a big client, and the client was extremely happy about this involvement. So it was less about that the client's involvement created new ideas. It was more that it was really attractive for the client to be involved. And the management then understood, oh, this is actually something really smart. And they did spread this more widely, where key account managers had the opportunity to involve very important clients in the design process as well. But this is still not the decision is being taken by everyone that it does. It's more that because there's so much support behind an idea, that the top management saw this as an opportunity and then decided to do something about it.
So it's about giving everybody a voice, but not a vote.
I think that's exactly what it
is. Yes. It's so what you're basically doing is you want to increase your surface area of success. Because you allow for these inputs, you know, externally, internally, giving them a voice, which is also, you know, in line with the trends on you know, expectations on the workforce and all the things you mentioned earlier, that makes a lot of sense. Then you have a lot of data, right? You have a lot of ideas, opinions, maybe even evidence, depending on how you manage the process. How could companies then manage the information overload, or let's say conflicting ideas that come with opening the strategy process?
Okay, you know, it depends a bit again on what exactly you do, which sort of process. In the nightmare competitor exercise, the way you converge is by having rounds of voting, and you sort of, you know, let those who participate in the process select more promising ideas until you're down to a manageable number of those ideas. If you do those massive open processes the way Steelcase did it, then you probably need some IT power behind it, some AI and machine learning type techniques. IBM is the company that probably did most of the development in this particular space. They use Watson, their supercomputer, and have a specific jam technology that helps both while an engagement, they call it strategy jams, where I think the largest engagement they ever had was with 160,000 people. So while this is ongoing, AI already helps the moderators to see certain ideas that they can bring others' attention to it. And afterwards, in order to analyze the data, they can again use some of those technologies in order to filter out things that are really good. For example, one tool that they have is a debater tool. And the debater tool on a particular argument then filters out the pro and con arguments for this specific idea, which helps you as a manager to afterwards see, you know, what are the different voices on a particular issue that has been discussed.
So if we turn to the, you know, the role of technology in all of this, you just mentioned a tool, the Debater tool, for example. And I think, you know, technology can, in this particular process or set of processes, can be, you know, can be a double-edged sword. Because of course, you know, they enable now the offering of platforms for collaboration, also for, you know, machine learning techniques for text analysis, even for reasoning. But in some occasions, they might also raise concerns about privacy, security, and all these things we're discussing today. Hallucination is another thing which might not necessarily be bad if you want to get to the extreme side of, you know, get me something out of a large language model that's very creative and novel and humans didn't think of. So it might also be a tool actually in some cases, hallucination, if you will. But, you know, what are some of the other tools that can be used? You mentioned JAMS and the Debate one. Is there more tools that are being applied today by some leading organizations in that process?
Sure, you know, there's a fair bit, yeah. One company I'm aware of that does something really cool is a small Dutch company. They're called Circlelytics, and they have a technique where they essentially use AI to confront you with ideas from other people who think very differently than you. So the way this works is company has a question. You know, let's say they lost 10% revenues and they're trying to figure out. So they post this questionnaire in that platform that the company has, the Dutch company, and asked their employees, why do you think we lost 10% revenue last term? And, you know, everyone writes answers, sort of, you know, Twitter length type answers to that. Then all of this goes into this sort of AI magic tool that the company has. And in the second round, everyone who participated first round gets 15 answers from people who thought very differently from that, from themselves. You then rate those answers. You can highlight certain words. You also have a possibility to respond to some of those things. And once again, there's a bit of AI magic going on to then, in the end, deliver the five best and the five worst answers from this entire exercise. I think, you know, it's a really smart way to get you thinking as you see how people think very differently about an issue that you put some thought into this. I also for a moment want to go back to this point that you made about, you know, hallucination and how do you deal with, you know, the input that you get. I guess we're talking particularly ChatGPT in this instance, as that's been the most widely used large language model in the past year as it's been so advanced. Now, when it first came out, I started to do a bit of research, mainly with Martin Reeves, who leads the BCG Henderson Institute, a think tank from the Boston Consulting Group on this. And one of the things that we did is we went through different strategy problems and engaged with the tool in a sort of conversation to see what the tool would suggest in this particular situation. And an important conclusion that we made, at least up to now, it is the best, the most experienced strategist that probably benefit the most from engaging with this tool. The reason is that it's highly convincing the way this tool responds, but you need to know how to ask questions and to maybe also push it in a certain direction if the answers, once you kind of in the know, really go somehow in the wrong direction. For example, we asked the tool to come up with an idea of an innovative new streaming service. And it was a sort of list of recommendations. One was an edutainment type streaming service. And, you know, me being a professor, I naturally was interested in this. So I started to probe more in this direction. At one point we got to, okay, so how do I get this off the ground? You know, I need obviously people to provide content for this. And the tool's suggestion was, well, you know, set up contracts with universities to get the professors to contribute. Now, working at a university, I know that this is not at all how universities work. Yeah, professors cannot be ordered really what to do. Professors do what they want to do. It's a nightmare for anybody who is in management in a university. But you know, that's a reality. Now, knowing this, you know, I started to probe more in that direction, and then you know, as I pushed in the right direction, it did come up with useful suggestions about you know. It's maybe more junior faculty where you can provide ability to get them more, public space, help them to become more known. That is most likely to contribute to this. So I need to target maybe this particular type of faculty rather than somebody who is already well known and is unlikely to just sort of, you know, provide content for you.
And how do you imagine the future of all of this looks like? I mean, you know, right now we're experimenting with all these tools and they're, you know, starting to get really useful in certain, you know, contexts and for certain questions, for certain tasks. Again, you know, probably there is a hype and maybe expectations are a little bit inflated these days as to what it can do exactly. And nobody knows exactly how it works and all the things that happen with emerging technology and maybe with, you know, technology disruptions on the horizon. And we can debate whether we are already in such a hit, you know, disruptive phase or not. But, you know, how, okay, now this is a crystal ball question, right? But in just from what you're seeing and what you're researching in these days, how do you imagine strategy processes, including maybe open strategy processes, are going to look like in a couple of years from now?
Okay, so I think in the shorter run, these type of technologies will become better and better as co-pilots. So people who are already in that strategy domain, they will use it in order to help them with the task, sort of, you know, maybe replace junior researchers, junior consultants that would gather some of the data to be more effective, maybe stimulate new ideas for them. There was a relatively big experiments that the Boston Consulting Group conducted recently involving around 100 junior consultants. Some of them used ChatGPT as support, some didn't. And they found that the tool was particularly good if there are tasks that requires the junior consultants to come up with new ideas, and they were beating those who had no support. Whereas the kind of classic problem solving tasks that you know, probably consultants who are hired by top firms like BCG are good at already. In this space, the humans were continuing to beat the tools, but we could also, you know, envision quite easily how even in these tasks, support from those tools is becoming, you know, a real advantage for those who are in the sort of, you know, strategy making side of things. That's one part, yeah. A bit more long-term, I do think there's opportunities for automations in some sort of strategy aspects. And the kind of market I see that this could be interesting for is for companies who cannot afford the expensive, highly qualified strategy consultants mm-hmm. in the first mm-hmm. place. Yeah, because here the choice is really be trying to figure it out yourself, and probably, you know, if you're a founder, if you're an owner of a mid-sized business, you're already so overloaded with work and you have a limited number of staff who can really devote their time to strategy, where a tool that can take over some of that that process, it does stuff that doesn't happen at all otherwise. So I think here I do see potential for going even in the direction of automation, or I mean, you know, there will always be some sort of sensitivity check from the person in the end who is responsible. But at least, you know, a more systematic strategy making possibility arises through those techniques.
And will this lead us in a time where things are getting even more accelerated?
What
because
do you
now, basically. Yeah, because every company, specifically the ones that cannot, you know, work on sophisticated strategies, now have the tools at hand to make things more competitive in the market. Because now, you know, they're strategizing against each other with tools that are available. So will this actually accelerate you know, competition and, you know, the rising levels of competition in the market, because, you know, everybody is kind of developing these supercharged strategies.
Yeah.
Is that where we are going?
Well, not necessarily. So when you look back at the last decade or maybe decade and a half, even though we talk about everything gets more and more competitive, the numbers don't necessarily speak that language, at least not in all industries. Yeah, you have a high concentration of power in a few big tech companies who can easily just eat up any competitor who comes along. You know, they make an acquisition, they squeeze them out of the market. So I don't necessarily more and more competition in all spaces. You know, there'll be other areas where this is probably true and is the case, but not across the board, just because we have this technology.
That's fair to say. Now, so we have opening up the strategy process, we have the role of technology in all of this. Let's quickly also look at the human side to all of this. So, you know, when we're advocating for open strategy, still, I think, you know, deeply ingrained corporate cultures are kind of challenged to some degree, because they often, you know, they opt for secrecy in many places these times. So, but at the same time, you know, openness, and we're probably talking about true openness, at a certain level of transparency, maybe not a 100%, but much more than what we've seen today. That also requires a level of vulnerability sometimes that maybe some of the leaders might be uncomfortable with, at least, you know, today. So what does it do, you know, opening up the strategy process, introducing technology, specifically AI technology, what does it do to, you know, leaders and executives on a human level, on a person level?
You know, one thing I always stress with CEOs, if they, you know, approach me about these open strategy techniques, if they're not into it, if you don't want to do this and truly want to do it, it's better not to do it at all. Yeah, because then we are in this place where you raise expectations, but in the end, you will ignore whatever comes out of this. You will not really share. So that's a choice. Yeah. And I would, you know, definitely don't want to argue that in all instances, opening up is the right answer. It depends on the circumstances. Even occasionally, there's legal barriers that would not make it possible, say, you know, in an M&A type situation where you simply are not allowed to do this. Or it might be a situation where you have proprietary information. If that gets out, then somebody else will quickly copy you and take away your competitive advantage. So, you know, again, in these circumstances, I would be reluctant to recommend to open up as well. And you also raised this important point about it depends on the culture of an organization. You know, some organizations are simply not like this. There might also be, you know, difference in different countries of how, you know, things are usually run in a particular society. So, you know, in some of those societies who are still more hierarchically organized, I tend to emphasize that, you know, it's not necessarily opening up to everyone, but it's a question of involving important stakeholders in this process. And that makes sense even in settings of that kind. So you know, there's a, it's not a black and white. It's, you know, on some sort of, you know, continuum where you either open up a little more, a little less, depending on the circumstances, and in some circumstances you actually won't open up.
And if we think about times in crisis, you know, we just, you know, basically globally you know, lived through a time of crisis with, you know, the recent pandemic that the world was going through, and I think particularly in times of a crisis we often like to think, you know, we need somebody, a captain of the large ship. They need to navigate through a storm, through, you know, dangerous waves and all these things. And, you know, in such a crisis situation, maybe you don't want everyone on the ship to be part of the, you said, decision-making process, but also maybe even the voting process, but you actually want someone to take responsibility, decide what to do next, radiate maximum confidence and basically tell others. Yeah. What to do. So is there also a, you know, a timing perspective in this, where I say, well, you know, in good times, it might make sense, but maybe in times that are tough, maybe, you know, go back or at least not open up as much. What is your take on that?
So first, yes, I agree that not at all times you would do that. Now, what I would be reluctant is to fully sign off in times of crisis. You need the charismatic superstar to somehow lead you. And in one of my previous books, I wrote about organizations that survive for 100 years and longer. And the move that most often ended a period where an organization was surviving and thriving was when they were reliant on this charismatic superstar, because that's when the sort of natural resistance from an organization goes down and they just follow sometimes blindly in this direction. Now, the results tend to be extreme. It could be that it's extremely good, but it can also be that it's extremely bad. Now, to this, my question tends to be, you know, what's your chance that your leader is Steve Jobs? It's a kind of one in a million, yeah? So you could have, in this one instance, this one charismatic superstar who is also just picking all the right spots. More likely, that's not the case, yeah? So why not go on a, you know, on the model, there's a bit more reliant on a slightly larger group of people and not just follows one person blindly. I noticed, it's taking us a little bit away from the core of our conversation, but I noticed with some concern of how in a growing number of countries on the political side, there is, you know, again, this strong attraction of a populist, super charismatic leader. And, you know, I feel that might have to do with most of the people no longer having memories of a period where, you know, this led to extreme and extremely bad results. Because, you know, obviously the worst example of them would be Adolf Hitler that we can think of. Yeah, but you don't even have to go to those extremes. Somebody who is sort of maybe a little bit less shiny, a consensus builder, is possibly more effective for a country. And, you know, the person, if sort of I have to put myself out there, that I, in the political sphere, admired a lot was Angela Merkel. That was not somebody who was maybe shiny. No one kind of, you know, thought that she would stand out among world leaders. But she was highly effective and was navigating Germany through a period that was not easy.
Very interesting. Very interesting perspective. And now, if we want, you know, our listeners of this episode to take away some, you know, if they consider, okay, well, you know, open strategy might be interesting. Obviously, you know, they just can go on Amazon or wherever and, you know, buy a book and start learning about this in greater detail. But what could be some, you know, first and also actionable steps if, you know, companies consider, or, you know, leaders, executives, whatever, you know, whoever is listening would consider, well, you know, it's worth a try or at least worth a thought. Where to start?
Okay, I guess the first thing you need to do is you figure out if yourself you're ready for this. Yeah, and there's sort of, you know, a few simple questions that you can ask yourself in order to prepare you, or to figure out whether you are ready. Yeah? So you can ask yourself whether you are a prince of Serendip. You might be familiar with this story about three princes going on a quest and all sorts of, you know, happy coincidences happen to them, which turn out to be an advantage for them. So are you comfortable with things that just happen to you and not having to know and pre-plan everything? The second question you can ask yourself: are you a Sebastian Bach or are you a Miles Davis? So Sebastian Bach, symbol of classical music, and Miles Davis, symbol of jazz. Jazz, you know, has an element of improvisation, and being more comfortable with more of an improvisation type of approach rather than pre-planned, well-executed kind of pass, again, you know, you're probably more comfortable with opening up your strategy. The third question you can ask yourself is, are you Adele? Adele, you know, the celebrated British singer, she is known for her voice. But when you look more deeply at her productions, you see that she was primarily a really strong team player that gave a lot of space and freedom for others to contribute to her productions. And that made their productions so fantastic. You know, are you comfortable with this? And finally, you need to ask yourself whether you love pirates. Now, this is a sort of, you know, a little nod to a group of people in NASA who managed to get themselves the freedom to come up with evolutionary ideas around building a mission on smaller computers networked together rather than a supercomputer. And they got this leeway to do that. So, you know, people who do not conform to the norms of your organization, are you comfortable with giving people some space? If you find yourself positively answering these four questions, then probably, you know, on a personal level, you are more prepared for what awaits you when you open up your strategy. Once you've gone through that, the second thing I suggest is start experimenting a little bit. Rather than, you know, doing a big thing in the very core business of your organization, take some small initiative, try out how things are, and have a kind of pilot. Yeah, if that works well, you might create momentum around that. Dr. Oetker, big German company, they first experimented with some of those techniques in the muesli business, which is a smaller business for them. After they saw how it worked, what worked, then they moved to the frozen pizza business, which is one of their biggest businesses.
And once you started experimenting with it, in case it goes wrong, is there a way back? Because you now raised all the expectations on collaboration, participation, again, giving everybody a voice, and maybe not a vote, maybe a smaller vote, or however you want to do this. Is there a way back, or is it you're now locked in?
No, you know, as you do it, hopefully in some sort of small space, you learn how things work and how things don't work. I'm generally a big fan of experimentation in the strategy domain. It's sort of, you know, easily overlooked because we think that strategy always needs to be the one thing and the one thing that works. But, you know, think of how many companies in the online space do A-B testing, yeah, sort of, you know, run multiple versions of a particular website, you know, in some cases, thousands of those versions. And through this constant testing of different versions, you figure out what works best, you know. If you perceive opening up your strategy in the same manner, where I do a little bit of an experiment here, okay, you know, certain things work that we can take around along to another version of this, which we try somewhere else until we figure out what's best. And then maybe, you know, we scale it to something more big. Then, you know, with that expectation, I don't think something that does not initially work necessarily kills it for all times.
Agreed. And who can we learn from? What companies are, you know, leading the way in this? What are some of their stories?
Okay. So, you know, one of my favorite stories I ever came across is from Barclays retail business. I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, Ashok Vaswani. And it was actually when he took charge of the retail business, it was in 2012, that he decided he wants to involve a large group of people in this strategy, future of the organization. The big sort of question that started to arise is banking is going more mobile, banking is going more online. What do we do? And put yourselves, you know, in the shoe of somebody who is taking this job in retail. They can probably expect a lot of resistance against online stuff because those who work at the counter of a bank, the first thing they'll think is, what about my job when they hear about this? So by involving them, you know, starting conversations that gives them a voice and an ability to think about how does it maybe change my job, but doesn't take my job away, you probably get a more positive engagement. So they set up this online jam, 3 days. Everyone was allowed to contribute. There are 30,000 people in Barclays retail in the UK, where you got very interesting conversations, yeah? So, for example, somebody mentioned in one of those discussion streams that Domino's Pizza can tell you quite a lot about their pizza, yeah? When you order it, they can tell you, we just got the order. And they can tell you ingredients are on. Then they can tell you this is going into the oven. They can tell you when it comes out of the oven, and they can tell you when it will arrive in your house. In the mortgage department of Barclays at that point in time, all they could tell their clients was in the beginning, we receive your application. And in the very end, you either tell them you get mortgage under whatever conditions or you don't get a mortgage at all. That's sort of a bit, you know, off considering that as a pizza company, I could tell my clients more about the pizza that that they order. And, you know, conversations of that kind made it real, allowed people to think about how technology actually helped them to do better in what they're doing. Now, you know, shortly after the exercise, Barclays introduced its first mobile app. Almost overnight, they got 1 million users. Today, more than 9 million users, one of the most successful fintech products in the United Kingdom. And that's a legacy bank. Yeah, they're 325 years old. They've managed to transition into this digital age. There were self-help groups springing up, the Digital Eagles, they called themselves, where those who are more digital literate help those who are less so. I heard a story about a grandfather showing up in one of the Barclays branches one day with his new iPad, saying that his grandson had told him, Barclays no digital, can they help him set up the iPad? Now, you know, not a computer store, but it highlights that the wider population in the UK do think that Barclays have arrived in the digital age. I think, you know, without this broad engagement, you would have never been able to bring everyone along into this new era.
And that's clearly an achievement. And I guess in your research, but also in your books, you highlight also, you know, other stories and the articles you write. So, you know, if anyone's interested to learn from others that are, you know, leading the way, you know, feel free to you know, look in the publications and also the posts that Christian, that you've made. Christian, this has been a fantastic conversation, but before this conversation ends, we actually have a new tradition on this podcast. And the tradition is that my previous guest leaves a question for the next guest without knowing who my next guest is and what we're going to talk about. So my previous guest left a question for you. Actually, her question was, will we ever go back to normal, or will everything keep on accelerating from on here onwards?
Well, you know, my answer, and I can go back again to the book that I've written about long-term success, is that we always think that we live in the most dramatic of times. But then, you know, put yourself in the shoes of a young man in 1941 who was sent to the front lines of the Second World War. Put yourself into the shoes of somebody living in the rural area in, you know, 19th century UK, and for the first time there's a train coming along. All of them would have also thought this is sort of stuff that have never happened. So, you know, my answer would be, I'm not sure we really do live in the most dramatic of times. It probably depends also where you live. Yeah, for people who are living in a conflict zone at the moment, you know, that's probably true for them personally. But, you know, for us sitting here comfortably somewhere in an office, you in Germany, me in the UK, you know, well, you know, I'm sure there's other people who had a bit more change and stress coming their way in the past. I don't necessarily think that we're in the most dramatic of all times.
And that's, you know, I can resonate very well with that. It's always a thing of perspective, and, you know, change is part of nature, and it has always been in different forms and, you know, sorts and speed as well. So thank you for that. And, you know, offline, I'm going to ask what your question will be for my next guest, but we'll not do this on record because for obvious reasons. And, you know, Christian, that's it for this episode. Really, thank you so much for being my guest. It was a pleasure to listen to you. Thanks for sharing your experiences.
It was fun. Thanks for having me.
And to everybody listening or watching, if you want to learn more, you know, we're going to link some of the assets and books that Christian has written in the show notes of this episode. Yeah, that's it. Thanks for listening. Take care and bye-bye.